Get informed no matter where you are or what you're doing. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now and get news when you want it on your schedule.
Big tech dominating our headlines.
Another win for Donald Trump.
A key inflation report.
These are short audio reports, 5 minutes or less, that bring you the latest headlines with context 24 hours a day. Stay on top of the latest news from around the world. Get it on your smartphone. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen.
The importance of the Dalai Lama for Tibetan Buddhists is hard to put into words.
He's our parents, God, Lord Buddha. He's everything for us.
Now, at the age of 90, he's given instructions for finding his reincarnation when he dies. I'm Marco Werman. Also on the show, we look toward the future in Gaza.
Gaza is unlivable. Infrastructure has been destroyed. Universities, schools, mosques, the water system. So the question is, what's the future for the Palestinians?
That is the question we're asking today. Plus, intense flooding around the world means a greater need for early warning systems. And Parisians finally take the plunge.
This is so chic, you know, to swim in the Paris Seine.
All that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us on this Monday. Carolyn Beeler is on assignment. People across the globe are grappling with catastrophic flooding. The devastation in Texas after this weekend's flash floods is the most recent horror. Floods there came on quickly and killed more than 80 people. Texans are not alone in their struggle with flooding, though. Just last month in Mokwa, Nigeria, floods killed some 150 people. And late last spring, more than 200 people died in Valencia, Spain, a torrential downpour that wiped out entire neighborhoods, leaving utter devastation behind. Early warning systems are a critical tool to help people respond to weather that is increasingly erratic and dangerous due to climate change. Bias Ahmed is a professor of risk and disasters at University College London. He joined us to discuss the effectiveness and accessibility of early warning systems.
We should not blame the rainfall. We should not blame the river water, all right, or the river itself. That's not the problem. The problem is within us. Our system of monitoring, detection, forecasting, and preparedness. Disasters are not natural. I think it's a massive failure for the decision makers, to be honest.
Yeah, so connect that failure to fatalities, because we look in Spain at the floods last spring, lots of fatalities. Let's go back to Pakistan a few years ago, so many deaths. Why does flooding in particular so often result in these large numbers of fatalities?
It is because of the lack of disaster risk knowledge and lack of preparedness and response capabilities. I mean, we get alerts in our through text, but we think, okay, no, this flood is not going to happen probably, or even it happens, it might not impact us. So there's a serious lack of warning dissemination and communication, and accordingly taking action to evacuate people on time.
Well, as you say, a lack of knowledge equals lack of preparedness. You mentioned text alerts. I mean, that is a basic form of an early warning system used in a place like Ghana. Explain the basic intent. Like, fundamentally, what are early warning systems meant to do to make flooding less catastrophic?
Sometimes we think by early warning system means you get something like a text message or a phone call, but that's not early warning system. There are four pillars of early warning system. Pillar one is disaster risk knowledge. It means you should have, like, the communities on the ground should have access to flood risk maps, and they should be knowledgeable about the pattern and the trend and all these different types of hazard categories. Second, you have the forecasting. But the most important, this is the second pillar, but the third pillar, that is warning, dissemination, and communication. Who are on the ground? Who can be affected? Who should be evacuated? Where are the high-risk areas? All these things, there it matters, and that causes the disasters. And the fourth pillar is preparedness and response capabilities.
Have you seen a system like this with all four pillars kind of in place, working the way it's supposed to?
There is no ideal early warning system nowhere in the world, first, you have to remember. But there are some systems, like in Bangladesh, in many other countries, in Europe, I mean, they have, through World Meteorological Organization, very strong early warning system. What they do, they try to reduce the loss and damage to all these four pillars. If these four pillars work like in order, you can reduce it. Some examples of failure are there, but that doesn't mean the whole system is a failure.
What about the technology for flood prediction? How's that evolved over the years?
Now, I mean, previously it was kind of rainfall forecasting, but now we have access to very high resolution satellite imagery. So mostly we use artificial intelligence and satellite imagery and advanced and reliable weather forecasting systems. We integrate all this into generating, observing, monitoring, and analyzing and forecasting flood hazard.
You know, humans receiving these alerts are all making their own decisions about what to do with the information and the data. How much of this is about teaching us human beings to follow the warnings?
Very important, most important, I would say. Rather than satellites, yes, all these components are needed, but most important is you should, whenever you get the alert, whatever is the advice from your meteorological department or local government agencies, immediately take action. Sometimes people do not believe on those warnings. I mean, we should invest on school-level training, community-level training, and respecting whatever your meteorological department provides you with alert and warning. Respect that and take actions immediately.
Bias Ahmed is a professor of risk and disasters at University College London. The Dalai Lama just turned 90 with his shaved head, easy smile, and those yellow and saffron robes. The Tibetan monk is one of the most recognized religious leaders in the world. Ahead of his birthday, the Dalai Lama made an announcement. He said he would be reborn after his death and that the Tibetan Buddhist community in India will have sole authority in finding his reincarnation. As the world's Matthew Bell reports, this sets the stage for a dispute with China.
For centuries, Buddhists have revered a long line of Dalai Lamas. They're believed to be the reincarnations of a supernatural figure called Chinrezig in Tibetan. The title translates into something like, "The Lord who looks down at the world in compassion." Today, many Tibetans also see the Dalai Lama as the embodiment of their culture and religion. A couple hundred Tibetans put on traditional clothes and gathered at the Karakula Center for Tibetan Buddhist Studies in Medford, Massachusetts on Sunday morning. They were there to celebrate the 14th Dalai Lama's 90th birthday.
So today is a very auspicious day for all of us, and we are celebrating all over the world.
Tinley Chodun is with the Tibet Association of Boston.
Literally, all Tibetans, he treats us like his own children. For him, he's our parents, God, Lord Buddha, he's everything for us.
Tenzin Gyatso, the 14th Dalai Lama, fled Tibet after a failed uprising against China in 1959. He's been based in Dharamsala, India, ever since, alongside a large community of exiled Tibetans. Traditional Tibet was a true theocracy, with the Dalai Lama as both the head of government and the supreme religious authority. But in 2011, the current Dalai Lama gave up his political responsibility and put Tibet's government in exile on a path to democracy. He also said that he may be the last Dalai Lama. But on Wednesday, he cleared up the issue about his reincarnation with this official video statement. The Dalai Lama said his followers want him to be reincarnated, so for that reason, he now expects it will happen. He went on to say that his office, based in India, will name the next Dalai Lama. That's a direct rebuke to Beijing, because China controls Tibet. It calls the Dalai Lama an anti-Chinese separatist and insists that Chinese officials have the ultimate responsibility for finding the next Dalai Lama. Kelsang Punsok, who's also with the Tibet Association of Boston, says he won't be surprised if China tries to name its own Dalai Lama after this one passes away. But he doesn't think it will work because of something the 14th Dalai Lama said years ago.
He said, "I'll be reincarnated in a free world, not in China."
Punzo says the Dalai Lama has earned respect and admiration from Buddhists and non-Buddhists alike for his message of compassion.
As long as you are one of the human beings, he said, we have to respect each other. We have to be kind to each other as mother treating their own son or daughter.
In the Buddhist tradition, after a high-ranking lama or guru dies, it takes time for religious authorities to locate his or her reincarnation, maybe several years. When that person is found, they're usually a toddler or young child who then enters a period of religious training that takes many more years. So it's conceivable that after the death of the current Dalai Lama, the position could be essentially vacant for 5, 10, maybe even 20 years.
That's what's going to be the big challenge for the Tibetans, both inside and outside Tibet.
Robert Barnett is with the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London.
They have set up a political system with a prime minister, they call a Sikyong, running the Tibetan government in exile. But that person doesn't have the kind of charismatic authority or religious, there's no religious figure. And the Dalai Lama has said that process should not only be democratic, it should be secular. It shouldn't have any Dalai Lama in the future involved in the politics.
Barnett says there have been quiet negotiations between Tibetan and Chinese officials in the last year or so, but very little is known about how those talks are proceeding. On Sunday, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi extended warmest wishes to the Dalai Lama on behalf of 1.4 billion Indians. In a statement read during celebrations in the Himalayan hill town where the Tibetan leader lives, Modi described the Dalai Lama as, quote, an enduring symbol of love, compassion, patience, and moral discipline. Three former U.S. presidents and the current Secretary of State all released statements of their own yesterday. Marco Rubio said the United States supports the right of Tibetans to venerate religious leaders without interference. For the world, I'm Matthew Bell.
If you watched the Summer Olympics last year in Paris, you may recall that some of the swimming events took place in the Seine. The city had spent $1.6 billion to clean up the polluted river to make the water safe in time for the Games. But the push for a swimmable river did not stop with the Olympics. Opening the Seine for public swimming has always been the real goal, according to Mayor Anne Hidalgo. And on Saturday, that became a reality. By the time three designated sites across Paris opened for swimming, there were already long lines of Parisians waiting to take their first dip. The sites are enclosed with lifeguards standing by. Swimmers were also required to tie yellow buoys around their waists as a precaution.
This is so chic, you know, to swim in the Paris Seine.
That's Lucille Woodward, a coach and influencer who lives in Paris.
I am so proud of Paris, because it's really fighting hard to give a little bit more space, area, a little bit more nature to the citizens.
This reopening is a long time coming for Paris. Swimming used to be popular in the Seine up until 1923, that is. That's when it was banned due to pollution and boat traffic. Cleanup efforts began in the 1990s when sanitation authorities invested more than $10 billion to revamp the sewer system to keep wastewater out of the river. Now authorities say those efforts have paid off, but some would-be swimmers like Pia Bienfait are still skeptical.
We wait for people to jump in, we'll see what happens, and if nobody gets sick, then I'm convinced and I will jump in. Until then, we'll wait.
Lucille Woodward, who sees the buoy as a fashion statement, is less concerned.
There are some apprehensions, of course, anytime you go to swim somewhere, but I think this is one of the most tested area in the whole world now. Because I don't think the town hall can authorize herself to have any problems. So I'm actually very confident on the people who are doing all these tests.
In other words, come on in, the water's fine. The U.S. has removed the terrorist designation from a group in Syria that's led by the country's new president. More about why that matters as Syria works to create a stable future. Just ahead, you're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Today, the U.S. State Department took Syria's Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, off its list of terrorist groups. Back in December, HTS was responsible for overthrowing Syria's longtime dictator, Bashar al-Assad, a decades-long regime that fell in less than 2 weeks.
Last week it was Aleppo, yesterday the city of Homs, last night the outskirts of Damascus.
At this point, it appears that the dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad is crumbling.
Taking HTS off the terror list marks one more important step toward ending Syria's isolation, starting with permitting Syria to be part of the international financial system. Syria's effort to create stability is captured in a new documentary from our GBH partners at Frontline. It's called Syria After Assad. Filmmaker Martin Smith spoke recently with The World's Carolyn Beeler and recalled how surprising Assad's ouster was back in December.
The only person that really saw this was Mohammed al-Jalani, the leader of the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham group that took Damascus. He had predicted that the fall was going to happen when Iran and Russia and Hezbollah were weakened. And that's what had happened. Hezbollah was fighting Israel, and Putin was fighting in Ukraine. And so when those distractions happened, the government of Bashar al-Assad, his army was all hollowed out for years of sanctions. So they just fell. It didn't take much.
Abu Muhammad al-Jalani, of course, was the rebel leader who toppled the Assad regime. He has now returned to, going by his birth name, Ahmad al-Shara. He's the transitional president now. But you were the first American journalist to sit down and interview him long before any of this happened, before he was president. What were your impressions of him when you met back then?
Yeah, he was surprisingly candid, surprisingly open. He seemed sincere in communicating through me to the rest of the world, which was his intention, that he should be reconsidered, that his roots as a al-Qaeda commander and as someone who had dealt with the leadership of ISIS, had taken money from them, in fact, he was persuading the world to reconsider him. And I felt like he was being quite straightforward and honest. Mm-hmm. The fact was that he wasn't interested in international terrorism, of attacking targets in London or New York or somewhere else. He was interested in defeating Assad. And he has realized that he needed to moderate to some degree if he's going to have regional support and Western support. And so he's taken a very different path than, say, other jihadist leaders like bin Laden.
You also have people like former U.S. diplomat Roger Karstens sharing their impressions of him. Here is Karstens speaking in your documentary.
Having worked for many four-star generals in the American military, I felt like I was talking to a very senior general, not that different than an American commander, who had a very deep understanding of warfare, economics, policy, what he wanted to achieve, how he might want to achieve it. I walked away impressed.
So, former diplomat there, impressed with al-Shara. As president, he has promised freedom. He has said that he wants to run a legitimate, lawful government. How has he delivered on those promises so far?
Well, it's early on, and it's hard to know how things are going to play out and whether or not he's not going to be deposed or, God forbid, be assassinated and thrust Syria into chaos. But he has made every attempt to put together a cabinet that reflects most of the Syrian people. And he is beginning to look at the issue of transitional justice and keeping people accountable for the crimes they committed under the 54 years of the brutal Assad regime. He's got challenges, however, and that is that a lot of minorities within the country do not trust him, and they are not ready to forgive him for his past.
Specifically, one of the minorities you focused on in your reporting was the Kurdish minority in northeastern Syria. You attended in April the Kurdish Unity Conference in Syria. What were they aiming to do there, and where do things stand now with this community?
At that conference, they were coming together, disparate Kurdish groups, to stand shoulder to shoulder in opposing a constitution that had been issued by al-Shara that they thought was not sufficiently recognizing them as full, equal Syrian citizens. So that was the reason for that conference. They're feeling still quite bitter about that constitution, and that's where we stand right now. Al-Shara has not been willing to revise that constitution.
This is one example out of others of how Shara will have to navigate different communities within Syria and try to bring together unity. What kind of mistakes or missteps have you seen so far that al-Shara has made?
You know, I think perhaps the biggest one is the one we were just talking about up in northeast Syria with the Kurds. You know, they had hoped that in the constitution they would be recognized by having the name of the country be the Syrian Republic. But instead, it's the Syrian Arab Republic. And Kurds are not Arabs. And they wanted Arab dropped. That has not been addressed. So there's a number of, you know, potential problems that are brewing there.
In your estimation, how fragile would you say Syria is right now and the peace that holds within Syria right now?
Well, let me say that the majority, I think the vast majority of Syrians are happy to see Assad gone, and they are in support of al-Shara, and they are pulling for him. So his popularity is very high, except among some minority communities, which amount to a significant percentage of the population. But the majority of Syrians are behind him. So how fragile is it? I think if other countries like Iran or like Hezbollah or the Russians are banished, are not going to operate inside the country, and America, as you know, have lifted sanctions or begun the process of lifting sanctions, that could help stabilize things, and it could be a lot more secure. When we were leaving the country, there was an outbreak of violence. It was even blocking our route to the airport. So it's not fully stabilized, I would say.
As someone who has reported from Syria many times, when you're walking around there or talking to people, what is the biggest single piece of evidence of real change that you see?
The fact that they can speak, the fact that they are not asking for their names or their faces to not be heard or shown. People are speaking. There's freedom to report. But there are people who helped us who were afraid that there could be retribution mm-hmm. from former regime elements if they are seen to have participated in such a documentary. So all fear has not been erased. Mm-hmm. And there are significant militias made up of former regime elements.
That's filmmaker Martin Smith speaking with Carolyn Beeler. Smith's new documentary for GBH's Frontline is called Syria After Assad. It's streaming now on YouTube and on PBS.org. More global news still to come this hour. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Top of mind today is the weather catastrophe in Texas that took the lives of at least 89 people. Accurate predictions of extreme flooding and how to get that information out fast, those are problems people face across the globe. Earlier this hour, we spoke with Bias Ahmed at University College London, who told us many poorer countries rely on satellite data from NASA and the European Space Agency to predict dangerous weather.
Knowledge can be shared. Tools and technologies can be shared with those countries who are really struggling.
UN head Antonio Guterres launched that early warnings for all initiative in 2022. With about half the world currently unprotected, talk about what the consequences could be if vulnerable countries especially don't have an early warning system.
There are many examples. South Asian countries are really struggling a lot, and also sub-Saharan African countries and also Latin American countries. Even the countries who have the top most highest quality system for forecasting, they're also struggling. So I would again say it's all about human decision. Your choice of decision making is most important.
That was Bias Ahmed, a professor of risk and disasters at University College London, speaking with us earlier today. July 7th, 20 years ago today, four bombs exploded across London, killing 52 people and injuring hundreds more. The attack was carried out by four young British men inspired by Al-Qaeda. They died in the blast, setting forth a trend of suicide bombings in Europe and marking the worst single terrorist event on British soil. UK police say they can better prevent such attacks now. But at the same time, as we hear from the World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry, the threat of extremism is more complex than ever.
On the morning of July 7th, London was in celebration mode.
The Games of the 30th Olympiad in 2012 are awarded to the city of London.
The city had just secured its bid to host the 2012 Olympics.
The UK is a cynical place and suddenly something's positive's happened for once. And so it was like this happiness, I suppose, you know, especially when you see all the newspapers on the trains.
Mustafa Gurtuldu was 24 at the time, and that morning he jumped on the tube at London's Liverpool Street station. He was running a not-for-profit design agency and was headed to central London to give a talk. At around 10 to 9, he says, he heard what sounded like a loud popping noise.
Like if you get like a juice carton and you blow it up and you step on it, it's like that kind of popping sound. But the train lifted up off the tracks. At first I thought we've gone over something, and then the lights went out. And slowly, smoke started filling in.
Breaking news we're getting from the PA Newswire that there's been reports of an explosion outside Liverpool Street station. That, of course,
over the next hour, it emerged that two more bombs had also exploded on the London Underground, and then a fourth device was detonated on the top deck of a bus.
There's been an explosion on a bus at Tavistock Place.
I remember, you know, getting out, seeing the bus in front of me that looked like someone had sort of taken a can opener to the top of it.
Maria Lovegrove is a former detective chief superintendent.
And seeing people with really devastating injuries and just the sort of look on people's faces of shock.
Back on the underground, Mustafa Gurtuldu managed to make his way to the last carriage of the train and jump onto the tracks. Later that morning, police announced that London appeared to be at the centre of a terrorist attack. In the following months, it emerged that two of the perpetrators had been on the radar of MI5, but the British Security Service didn't consider them to be a high enough risk to justify further investigation. Maria Lovegrove says relations between local police and the intelligence agencies have improved greatly since then. She moved on to lead Prevent, the police arm of the UK's counter-extremism programme. The problem today, she says, is that extremist groups are far more diverse than before.
We continue to see the persistence of Islamic extremism, but we also see an increasing rise in extreme right-wing terrorism and people showing an interest in other violent ideologies.
Rashad Ali, a counter-terrorism practitioner in the UK, says someone prone to violence can now go online and pick and choose a grievance or an ideology that they can then use to justify an attack. The challenge is convincing tech platforms to remove the hateful content.
I regularly find material and report it in a very extreme racist material, and it'll often come back that this material doesn't contradict their rules of social interaction on the platform.
And Ali says you can't ignore the political reality of the world we live in. Major conflicts like Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the war in Gaza can easily be used by extremist groups to fuel anger, he says.
The narrative framing is that these are things that Western states as a whole either don't care about, support, or turn a blind eye to. And it creates a dynamic which basically says radical action is required.
Maria Lovegrove says fighting extremism is not something the police can do on their own.
Parents need to be more vigilant in, you know, thinking about what their children are doing and what they're accessing online. We need tech giants to be more responsible. It's a whole societal challenge, really, and an international one.
Today, a memorial service was held in St Paul's Cathedral in London, and the names of all of those who died in each of the explosions were read out.
James Adams, Samantha
Badham. Philip Beer.
Survivor Mustafa Kurtuldu didn't attend today's service. He says he can no longer face going to memorial events.
I used to go to the memorial in Hyde Park, but then I just break down in tears, like just every single time. And then my wife said, why are you doing this? Like, you're hurting yourself. This is not helping.
Today, he says, he'll spend the day with his wife and children and their two kittens. Just doing everyday stuff together, he says, because that's what helps him get through days like this. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
In Washington today, President Trump is hosting Benjamin Netanyahu. It's the Israeli Prime Minister's third meeting with the president since Trump took office in January. Trump has talked about the importance of getting a ceasefire deal in place for Gaza. Hamas and Israel have been holding indirect negotiations, and diplomats say they could be close to an agreement. Meantime, the devastation in Gaza continues. More than 1,000 people have been killed there just in the past 12 days, including Palestinians lining up for food. That's according to the Ministry of Health in Gaza. It has been 21 months since the start of Israel's military campaign, but it's still far from clear what the future looks like for Palestinian civilians there. For his view on what's at stake, we reached out to Fawaz Jurjis. He's a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics.
Hamas has been devastated. The top leaders have been killed. But what has happened in the 20 months is that Hamas has morphed into an insurgency. It has become decentralized. You have still 20,000 Hamas fighters spread all over the Gaza Strip. I mean, if you really want to know what's happening, see the Israeli casualties almost on a weekly basis. So even though Hamas, the top leadership, has been weakened, Hamas still standing. It's down, but it's not out. 20,000 insurgents are deeply embedded in their own communities. This will be forever war, regardless of what happens. And what Israel has been trying to do is to create alternative to Hamas by supporting and funding individuals with some tribal and ethnic influence in Gaza. What we could witness is an internal war between Hamas and Israel-supported fighters.
Well, with the loss of control of Gaza by Hamas, there are reports of armed gangs stepping into the void. Is that what you're talking about? And how much are these gangs comprised of former Hamas fighters?
We don't know the extent of the gangs. All we know is that the gangs and the riffraffs and basically criminals have been attacking aid, humanitarian aid places, attacking humanitarian officials, because you have chaos in some parts of Gaza. Hamas cannot really show its face. So the gangs and the criminals and Israel-supported, basically, fighters can do a great deal of damage. They're doing a great deal of damage. And I think the bigger point here, more and more Palestinians are fed up with Hamas. More and more Palestinians are saying enough. The 2 million Palestinians have been battered and killed and starved in the past 20 months by Israel. And some of them blame Hamas. And I think that's why Hamas now is genuinely desperate for a ceasefire.
So when you mention gangs attacking aid distribution, you're moving into something I wanted to ask you about, this huge issue post-ceasefire. Which groups are permitted to distribute aid in Gaza? Why is that a key question right now, even before a truce is put in place?
Because this is an instrument of control, where Hamas and the Palestinians and Qatar and Egypt insist that United Nations and humanitarian aid should be basically in charge. What the United Nations has been saying is that Israel has weaponized aid since this Israel-US aid initiative.
The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation.
Exactly.
Yeah, and people are being gunned down on an almost daily basis while they're seeking food from the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. A lot of criticism around that. Is the foundation here to stay, though?
The United Nations will have nothing to do with it. Europe will have nothing to do with it. What has happened in the past 2 weeks or so, you're talking about hundreds of Palestinians who have been gunned down by the same aid officials who supposedly are trying to help the Palestinians. So it has been exposed for what it is.
The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, though, it is backed with massive resources. It's currently the only game in town. I mean, is there any other alternative?
At the end of the day, that's what the ceasefire is all about. Hamas insists aid will return to what it used to be before Israel violated the ceasefire in March.
I'm just wondering, with Benjamin Netanyahu back in Washington meeting with Trump today, what is Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia telling Trump right now?
The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia used his leverage to get Donald Trump to lift the sanctions on Syria. And he did so. Yet, we have not seen any leverage used by the Arab state regarding the Palestinians in Gaza. The reality is the key Arab states who have leverage with Donald Trump have decided not to use their political capital now, because for them, bilateral relations with the United States is much more important.
Fawaz Jurjis of the London School of Economics. His most recent book is titled The Great Betrayal, The Struggle for Freedom and Democracy in the Middle East. Every year, hundreds of athletes descend on the Turkish city of Edirne for the world's oldest competitive sporting event, an oil wrestling championship. Yes, not just wrestling, but with oil for an extra challenge. In a practice dating back to ancient times, wrestlers are covered in olive oil before each match, making it obviously difficult for their opponents to get a good grip. The world's Duri Bascaran went to check out this year's competition, where slickness makes a difference.
A match begins on a grassy field. Two men lock their arms around each other's shoulders, their faces pressed next to each other. The oil on their backs glistens in the midday sun and drips into their eyes. Each wrestler wears a pair of black calfskin pants that cut off just below the knee, the name of their hometown stamped across the backside with metal rivets.
Very few things here seem to be off limits. Hitting the head is fine, hitting the neck is fine, touching the head, pushing it into the ground, even reaching hands down the back of your opponent's trousers. This is a very physical sport.
In most wrestling competitions, says trainer Alper Murat Erdoğan, a larger athlete will beat a smaller one. But oil helps to level the playing field.
Yani yağ olduğu zaman işin içine teknik giriyor.
When there's oil, technique comes into play. Speed comes in, Erdoğan says. It's not just about force.
Bu yüzden yağlı olması pehlivanlığı yani.
This is why wrestlers use oil, he says. When the body is painted with it, the game is based on ambition, courage, and mental strength, not just the body. Oil wrestling goes back to ancient Egypt and the Sumerians. It was part of the original Olympic Games. And in Edirne, some 800 wrestlers go through 2 tons of olive oil over the course of the week-long competition. In the press box, I meet 73-year-old Sinan Alışkan, a sports photographer who has covered this tournament for half a century. When a competition is 664 years old, traditions run deep. There's a moment before each match, Alışkan explains, when wrestlers take a knee and tap the ground, their knee, lips, and forehead. It's a prayer, Alışkan explains, to say, I came from God, I will go to the earth. And that's how the match starts. A match ends when one wrestler flips his opponent onto his back with his belly to the sky, a rule that dates back to Ottoman times. This can take hours, so organizers recently introduced time limits. Many eyes today are on Yusuf Can Zeybek, a 31-year-old wrestler who has won the championship 2 years in a row. But he loses in the quarterfinal, a huge upset. The final matchup is between Orhan Okulu, a seasoned former champion, and Feyzullah Aktürk, a 26-year-old newcomer who came from mat wrestling. In the athlete's rest area, one wrestler stands with his head under a water fountain, trying to cool down. Another lays down with a towel and ice packs. It's 96 degrees in Edirne today. Aslihan Kaplan Susuz, the wife of a top-ranked wrestler, says the heat makes the tournament harder each year. No one knows the background. My husband prepares so much. He does so much, she says. The threat of heat stroke is real. One 25-year-old wrestler died from a heart attack in his hometown last week while preparing for the competition. As the final match begins, Orhan and Feyzullah are locked together, shoulder to shoulder. Their 10-year age difference is like a generation in wrestling.
judging by facial expressions, Faizullah looks a lot less tired. It looks like he's waiting Orhan out.
Faizullah. Genç.
A security guard presses his face up against the fence, watching intently. He says he's supporting Faizullah because he's young. Suddenly, the seemingly exhausted Orhan manages to pick up Faizullah's leg and push him backwards, off balance, and flip him onto his back. Fans storm the field, pick up Orhan, and carry him around the stadium in a victory lap. At 36 years old, Orhan Okulu again takes the championship and 1 million Turkish liras, the equivalent of $25,000. At least this time, experience has triumphed over youth. For the world, I'm Derya Buscarin. Edirne, Turkey.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Norway, there was a recent clash between a mining company and the country's indigenous Sami people, and it was just the latest point of tension in an ongoing struggle, and also a reminder of the complex threats to traditional Sami life and culture. Deutsche Welle's Lars Bevanger sent this report from Tromsø, Norway.
The native Sami populations of northern Norway, Sweden, Finland and Russia have made a living off the land for millennia. Reindeer herding is still central to their culture and survival. Since the 1800s, however, they've been in conflict with the nation states over natural resources and access to land. Today, the Sami are facing increasingly complex challenges to their way of life. Temperatures are rising nearly four times faster in the Arctic, and environmental programs like wind farms aimed at mitigating this fact also impacts the Sami's way of life.
I'm Aili Geskidalo. I'm an indigenous advisor for Amnesty Norway and the former president of the Sami Parliament in Norway. The Nordic states are allowing a kind of bit-by-bit eating of Sami lands. And that has a great impact, a scary impact on the foundation of the Sami culture. And because we live cross-border, nobody seems to take the full responsibility of protecting the areas we need for our livelihoods and for our survival.
For the past 40 years or so, Samis have had their own parliaments in Norway, Sweden and Finland, but only the Norwegian one gives them some decision-making powers over land rights. Samis are also represented on the Arctic Council, the intergovernmental forum for cooperation between Arctic states. Yet they have no voting rights there, and their role is advisory.
So where have things gone wrong? Because clearly in Norway there's been several court cases between the Sami population and the Norwegian state. Why is it impossible to sit down and talk about it?
Well, talking about it is a good thing, but it's not enough. We need the states to implement indigenous people's rights to free, prior, informed consent when it comes to land use. With climate change and the consequences of climate change, the double effect is quite disturbing and destroying the natural foundation for our culture.
Earlier this week, Sami demonstrators alongside Norwegian environmentalists were forcefully removed by police from the site of a new copper mine in the high Arctic north of Norway. Direct action like this is nothing new. Back in 1979, a semi-permanent Sami camp was set up outside the Norwegian parliament in Oslo in protest against a proposed hydroelectric dam in Sami areas. The project went ahead. In May this year, the Norwegian Sami parliament met the Norwegian state in court over Norway's latest energy project, which will see a dramatic increase in wind farms and pylons in Arctic Norway.
The strategy of building wind turbines in reindeer herding areas, it's a big threat against our culture. And we struggle with having our voices heard.
Sandra Maria West is a political advisor for the governing council of the Sami parliament in Norway. She argues they were left with no option but to take the state to court over the energy project.
That is a decision that the Norwegian government made without making impact assessments and without consulting the Sami parliament. They announced their strategy and decision, and 2 days later we got a reply to the letter that we sent 7 months prior, and they said, no, this is not a matter of consultation. In our opinion, this is grave. It will have enormous consequences on Sami culture, and that is why we have taken the Norwegian government to court on this matter.
What would you like to see done so that you have more representation? It sounds like you're not quite satisfied with the status quo.
No, you're right. I'm not satisfied. If we're going to have real consultations, then actually both parties need to want to find a solution. It's not a real consultation if we are meeting the government and they have already made up their mind.
The Arctic North is also an important front line with Putin's Russia. And now that Sweden and Finland are NATO members alongside Norway, military activity is increasing in Sami areas. Again, with not enough consultation, points out Laura Jonkaukio, a professor of Northern Politics and Government at the University of Lapland in Finland.
As in the context of the green transition, we are in a situation in which the Sami have to sacrifice disproportionately things that are important for their security in service of national security. For example, the Finnish state, when it signed the defense cooperation agreement with the United States, there was an area in the Sami homeland region in Finland included in this agreement, but the Sami were never consulted.
The Norwegian government says both the constitution and several legal provisions secure sufficient legal frameworks and consultation mechanisms to safeguard Sami rights when it comes to energy development and military activities in northern Norway. The next test of this is just around the corner when the court will rule in the case the Sami parliament brought against the Norwegian state last month.
Lars Bevanger is with our partners at Deutsche Welle, DW. One last thing before we go today, an update on two of Central Europe's biggest rivers, the Vistula in Poland and the Danube in Hungary. They sound more lively than they currently are. Water levels in both rivers have hit record lows due to an early summer heat wave combined with a lack of rainfall. And now some parts of the Danube are down to just about a half foot of water, forcing Hungarian shipping officials to put new restrictions on cargo ships. To comply, boats are only carrying 30 to 40% of their regular capacity. The situation could have major economic implications. Shipping rates are projected to rise by as much as 100%. But relief is in sight. Next week's forecasts call for rain. So with some hope, it won't be long before ships can once again get Europeans their goods at standard rates. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. And find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our new channel there. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here again tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Janae Elzey, Vicky and Michael Isip, Genji Kohan, Ashton Peary and Kate Wolf, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. From PRX.